The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyrie, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 21. I'm your host, Otis Gyrie, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Brian Martinez, Dominic Eagle, Finn McCool, and Dale Thompson. Tonight, we'll hear stories of fractious fathers, frightful families, satanic sons, and persistent phantoms. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. At least with a haunting, you can usually say a few words, solve some long-forgotten puzzle, or just feed a small pet to a closet and the problem is solved. But there are darker forces in the universe, and such simple answers fail to get rid of them. Tonight, we hear about the monstrous things that attach themselves to an unfortunate soul and won't leave until they've taken every last little drop. Some people have a great relationship with their family, others not so much. Here, from author Brian Martinez, is one of the latter, where a father and son are reunited by a medical emergency in not-so-happy fashion. But the reasons they dislike each other may run deeper than your usual personality clashes. Without further ado, I present to you, This Will Be Yours. It's only been my 30th birthday for an hour when I get the call. I think that maybe it's an overexcited friend who can't wait until morning to wish me a good day until I realize that, one, I don't recognize the number, and two, I don't really have friends. Instead, it's an administrator from a hospital I'm not familiar with. Not until she tells me the town. Then, I'm picturing the construction site I got arrested for drinking in, the water tower I nearly fell from, the school where I smoked weed on the roof, and the broken bedroom window flecked with my blood. "He put me as his emergency contact?" I ask, hoping she doesn't notice how badly I butcher my words, and she tells me that yes, I'm the only name on her list. I set down my glass and tell her to take me off it, that I don't know him, never did, but thank you so much for calling and have a good night. Before I hang up, she says, "Just for your own curiosity, would you like to know what happened to your father?" 16 hours later, I'm punching the roof of my car as I take the ticket and watch the automatic arm raise up like a guillotine in reverse. Then I'm spiraling up the parking garage by car and back down on foot. The air is so cold I can't feel my nose. Walking through the hissing doors of a hospital I still don't know the name of, though I think it has something to do with Mercy. The man at the front desk can't find the room number. I'm tempted to take it as a sign to turn around and head home, but then he finds it and gives me a sticker with my name and a number to put on my chest. The hospital halls smell like bleach, presumably because most people prefer it to the smell of piss, but that's debatable for me. At least piss doesn't bring back memories of scrubbing a bathroom floor on bare, shaking knees. I take a wobbling elevator to the fourth floor and walk past a dozen rooms until I find the sign that matches the number over my heart. For 6 minutes, I stand outside the door telling myself it's not too late. I can be watching cartoons on my couch by dinner time. But then my legs betray me, and before I can stop them, I'm standing by Lawrence's bedside watching him sleep. Maybe it's the sickly green hospital gown, or the flickering fluorescent lights, but he looks like he's aged 30 years in the last 10. His eyes have that sunken-in look of a man on an emergency room diet and detox plan. And his skin? It's got the pale, clammy tone to match. Like a figure in one of those wax museums that makes kids cry and teenagers laugh. Mostly, though, he looks small, the same way as when you're visiting your old elementary school and wonder who shrunk all the urinals. When his eyes eventually blink open and focus on me, those dark gray stones, I don't feel relief or remorse for the time lost or any of those things I assume other people would feel in that moment. More than anything, I can't believe I'm missing my cartoons for this. "What the hell are you doing here?" he asks. And I have to admit, it's a pretty good question. Lawrence spends 2 weeks at the hospital, followed by 3 months in a rehab facility, exactly 90 days that his insurance will pay, and then a white van with a yellow mechanical ramp drives him home. The driver has me sign his pad and then deposits Lawrence, wheelchair and all, in front of the garage like he's parking an old car with bad teeth and a beer gut. Growing up, we had the greenest lawn on the block, maybe the whole town. Even through the fall and halfway into the winter, the grass out front looked like it belonged on one of those fancy golf courses Lawrence was always talking about joining. His wife dreaded dinner time, and his son prayed for one of the factory machines to swallow him whole. But damn if Lawrence didn't have that lawn just the way he wanted it. Now, though, it looks off. Regardless of it being winter, the length of the dead weeds tells me he hasn't touched it in years. It's comforting to know that the neighborhood sees him for exactly who he is now. It's just a shame it's too late to do anything about it. The van pulls away, and Lawrence waits for it to turn off the block before he even glances at me. "I told them not to call you," he says, where most people would just say thanks. "Yeah, well, it doesn't work like that. The rehab wouldn't let you go home by yourself, and the aid doesn't start until..." "I don't need that," he cuts me off. "Sure, I give it a month before they find you with a broken neck. I'm not paying some stranger to wet my ass and tuck me into bed. It's my house," he adds. "And you're taking such good care of it," I'd say, nodding to the sagging porch. He sniffs, digging through the duffel bag in his lap for keys. "You can get in your car and go back to wherever you've been hiding," he says, pressing the button that opens the garage door. "I've been doing fine without you worrying about me." "You think I'm worried?" I have to stop myself from laughing because, seriously, it's just about the funniest thing I've heard all year. I lean into his good ear to make sure he can hear me over the noise of the garage door rising up. "I want to be perfectly clear about something. I'm only here because of one person, and they sure aren't sitting in that chair. Now, like I was saying, the aid doesn't start until Monday, which means you're my burden for the next 3 days. If you want to kick me out at that point, go right ahead. But until then, I'm sitting on one side of the house and you're sitting on the other, and we don't have to say a damn word to each other. In fact, I'd prefer it." I show him three fingers. "That many days, and then you're someone else's problem. Then you can wheel yourself into the ocean for all I care." The garage door goes quiet. He stares up at me, the monster he's made, and says, "That's how you talk to your father?" "No," I reply, "that's how I talk to you." I grab the handlebars and roll him inside, shutting the doors behind us. He complains that he can wheel himself in, yet he doesn't bother to try, not until he throws all his stuff on the kitchen table, awkwardly grabs a bottle of beer from the fridge and heads to the living room. The house is cleaner than I expected. Not as nice as Mom used to keep it, but decent enough. The wallpaper is yellowed from cigarette smoke, though, and the air is damp with the kind of mildew that settles into a place when the windows haven't been opened in years. The only thing still intact in the sitting room is the couch, suffocated in plastic the way Mom left it. At the front door of the house, at the bottom of the stairs that lead to the second floor, a stain, a dark stain the size of my hand, has absolutely ruined the carpeting. About halfway up, two of the guardrails holding up the railing are snapped in half, where some part of Lawrence struck them on the way down. As I look up at them, trying not to step in the carpet stain, I have to wonder which was louder, the guardrails breaking or Lawrence's legs. "Do you need anything?" Lawrence, his wheelchair parked in front of the living room couch, looks up from the TV as if I'm a hypnotist who just snapped his fingers. For a moment, he almost looks pitiable. Then his usual scowl comes crashing back, that condescending glare I grew up under, and just like that, the moment passes. "Dinner," he grunts, returning to the cars driving around in circles, and in my head I keep repeating, "3 days. 3 days. 3 days. The food in the fridge is coated in a rainbow of mold, from white to green to purple and back again, the stink of which hits my nose in one unwelcome wave. Which, yeah, is what happens when you leave the fridge unattended for 2 weeks and 3 months. That means I'll have to hit the supermarket, so Lawrence doesn't starve under my watch. But considering how late it is in the day and the fact I already have a beer in my hand. It'll have to wait till tomorrow. At least Lawrence still has the decency to fill every fridge in the house with cheap beer. I order a pizza and drink my beer on the porch to get the stench of rotten food out of my nostrils. The cold wind blowing right through me, teeth chattering against the bottle. The night's quiet, and eventually the kid shows up with the pizza and I toss a few slices onto a plate and drop it in Lawrence's lap. Grabbing a few slices for myself and another beer, I step over the dark stain and head upstairs to check out my old room. I either forgot that I have to pass Mom's bathroom to get there, or some part of me wanted to get a look at it because I find myself standing in the hallway, beer and pizza in hand, peeking through the open door like I'm 15 again, and afraid of what I'll see. My heart curled up in my throat. Before I get a glimpse of the bathtub, I shut the door and continue to my old room. It's exactly how I left it all those years ago. Band posters on the wall, bed unmade, closet full clothes, baseball trophy on the nightstand, and it's like stepping into a time machine, except as a side effect, it induces a panic attack. For a while, I sit on my old bed and work on my breathing until I can eat and drink. By the time I remember that I left my backpack with my clothes in the car, the sun's gone down and I don't feel like going out to get it. What I will go for, though, is another beer. So I head back down, past Mom's bathroom, down Lawrence's stairs over his dark stain, and into the kitchen. I keep quiet to avoid getting pulled into an argument, so it's somewhat of a relief when I hear Lawrence is still in the living room, in front of the TV, talking to someone on the phone. It's hard for me to imagine anyone who still talks to Lawrence at this point, but to their credit, they seem to be giving him a hard time, at least based on the defensive answers, shooting them back like he's afraid of them. I grab two beers to make sure I don't have to come back down, then a third to be safe. On a whim, I toss all the rotten food I can find in the garbage bag, tie it up and toss it out on the porch. Call me crazy, but it makes me sleep better knowing I'm not lying under the same roof as a laboratory's worth of deadly mold. I say that, but really, I'm doing it for the sake of the beer. As I grab the beers and turn my head in for the night, I notice something strange. Lawrence's duffel bag and discharge papers are still on the table where he left them, along with his phone. It's strange, considering I thought he'd just been talking on it. By the time I stick my head in the living room to check on him, though, Lawrence is already nodding off in his wheelchair. Not my problem. He could piss his pants, his chair, and the floor for all I care. He's made it clear he doesn't need anyone's help, least of all mine.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
I wake up in the middle of the night with my bladder kicking me in the stomach. For a second, I'm a kid again, alone in my room, Their chest is cold as a corpse, but then it all comes back at once. The years, the loss, the fall. The empty beer is next to the trophy on the nightstand, and I pull myself up and stumble out of that dead childhood to take a piss. Mom's bathroom's out of the question, so I shuffle past its closed door to the guest bathroom at the end of the hall, the one where I once spit a tooth into the sink and unleash a torrent into the toilet that hasn't been touched in years. Still has a house phone, I mumble. It's the only thing that makes sense. I don't remember seeing a landline, but that doesn't mean there isn't one. These old people can't part with the past, and I suppose that, yeah, a landline is still important for emergencies. Imagine if this little accident had happened on a bad network day. No reception and him bleeding out with two broken stumps folded under him. It's almost enough to make a guy smile. As I'm finishing, a noise out in the hallway perks my ears and stops me from flushing. A soft dragging like someone drawing their fingers across the bathroom floor. I stay perfectly still, back bent, hand on the flusher, listening to a sound that doesn't fit, doesn't make sense, and I have to ask myself if this is a dream, if I'm still back in a bed I just pissed. I decide that no, I'm not asleep, and yes, I really did hear what I'm hearing. There's no way it's Lawrence. He would have gotten out of his chair and dragged himself up the flight of stairs like a sack of dirty laundry. If he even had the strength to do something so ridiculous, he still wouldn't do it, for the simple fact that I'm up here and he wouldn't want me to think he's coming to check on me. That means whoever's out in the hallway doesn't belong in his house. Without flushing, without making a sound, I slowly reach for the door handle, getting ready to catch whoever it is out there. The dragging noise, the light scratch of fingertips on paint, is further down the hallway now, outside of Mom's bathroom, if I had to guess. And the idea of a stranger so much as touching that door chokes me with rage. I twist the doorknob, wrench the door open in one motion, rushing out to catch the intruder by surprise, but somehow, there's no one in the hallway. I rush down to check that all the doors are still closed, except for mine, which I left open, ducking in to make sure no one's hiding in there. The night's quiet, and the hallway empty, though there's a smell in the air like someone struck a match. It's a faint odor, but an unmistakable one, and the thought of an intruder with fire in mind sends me running down the stairs. After checking the rest of the house and finding nothing, no strangers, no dragging fingers, not even an out-of-place smell, I step into the living room to check on Lawrence as an afterthought, a way to finish a checklist. Apparently, after I turned in for the night, he managed to change into an undershirt and sweatpants and haul himself onto the couch by himself. I can't imagine how long that would have even taken him. How much he exerted himself, probably slick with sweat by the time he was done, huffing and panting. But then maybe he should have thought of that before he decided to be a mean bastard his entire life, and then go and get himself paralyzed. Standing there over him, smothering any attempt at feeling sorry, with memories of who he is, I hear whispering. It's soft and deep, and it takes me a few seconds to realize it's coming from Lawrence. He's talking in his sleep. His lips barely move, though his expression looks pained. I can only make out a few words of it, but sounds like there's nothing left. As I pass back through the kitchen, I consider grabbing a beer to help me fall asleep, what with my heart and brain slam dancing, but I decide, it's not worth it. What if I wake up having to piss again and the cycle starts over? Forget it, I'll fall asleep the old-fashioned way. Back upstairs, I find a normal hallway, even with the struck match odor faded to nothing but a memory. It feels like a dream, the kind your mind makes up when you're half asleep and half whatever else. And I drag my feet back to my old bedroom, looking forward to being taken back in by sleep. Halfway there, I stop walking. I played enough Spot the Difference as a kid, the game where you compare two pictures and try to figure out what's changed, to know there's one thing that isn't how I left it. my mother's old bathroom. I know I closed the door earlier, even checked that it was still shut. But now here I am, not blinking, and there it is, wide open. And that bathtub, something about it, something in it, even, I swear it's staring at me. I almost sleep straight through the morning, though I feel like I didn't sleep at all. Then I look out the window to find it's been snowing, which is just great, considering I have to hit the few stores to make sure there's food in the house till Monday. So I throw on one of Lawrence's old coats, trudge to the backyard, and dig out a shovel from the half-rotted shed to attack the snow with. The snow's wet and heavy, with each shovelful, last night's fear turns into something darker. Something like me. Lawrence's fault. Once the driveway's clear enough to pull my car out, I leave the shovel on the porch and stomp with wet shoes back inside, spine stiff, and cold air matted to my forehead, and discover Lawrence has changed his clothes and wheeled himself into the kitchen to look through the empty cabinets. I'm going to the supermarket, I say before I can ask. Any brand of slop you prefer? Instead of answering, he pops open a can of instant coffee. The way my head's pounding, I could snort lines of it, but I'd rather suffer than ask him for a cup. By the way, I add, do you still have a home phone? He looks over at me for the first time. What kind of stupid question is that? Stupid because you do, and stupid because you don't. He grunts. Why would I waste my money on something I don't use? Stupid, you don't. I conclude. He goes back to preparing his coffee, straining to reach the counter. Did you clean off my car? He asks, and I try not to smile as I reply. Why would I waste my time on something you don't use? The roads, I soon find, are a mess. Some cars skid and slide on unplowed blacktop. Others go at a crawl to avoid doing the same. The more I sit with Lawrence's conversation, the one he had without the phone, the less I like it. I don't like much that's happened in the house the past day, and not in the ways I'd expected. Well, not just in the ways I'd expected. At the supermarket, I fill a cart with canned beans and corn, boxes of instant macaroni, and every microwave dinner meatloaf they have, plus a few pizzas for myself. Passing through an aisle of calculators and alarm clocks, I spot a display of cheap home surveillance cameras and toss two into the cart. Back at the house, I find more wet footprints than I remember making. When are you leaving? Lawrence asks me over his full plate of microwaved meatloaf. I tell him Monday and not a second later. Good, he replies. You're drinking me out of a house. I only have two beers with my frozen pizza, then turn in early and make sure the app on my phone is connected to the camera. It shows me the living room from up on the shelf where I put it, the scene tinted the greenish black and white of infrared. As he's done for the past day and 20 years leading up to it, Lawrence watches TV from the couch, his eyes like two black voids, thanks to the night vision. For a while, I watch him laying there, switching occasionally to the camera in the upstairs hallway, but it doesn't make for the most exciting viewing, and pretty soon, my eyelids feel syrupy and my legs grow heavier and heavier, until it seems I'm about to fall right through the bed and then the floor, leaving behind a hole in the shape of my silhouette, like in the cartoons that rotted my brain. I know I'm dreaming because Mom wasn't around by the time I got to college, and yet here she is in my dorm room, standing over me as I lay on the floor, and before that, turning my head to make sure I don't aspirate on what comes back up. Even through the bile of my nostrils, she smells like dirt and lilies. Then something is wrong with my chest. My solar plexus, shaking like a honeybee hive, then senses an intruder. Before Mom can warn me, I touch my hand to it and feel the hard mass there, like a mushroom of cancer growing up from my chest. And then it shakes again beneath my fingers, and I realize that no, it's my phone, and no, Mom's dead. My eyes open, and a second later my hands start to work again, grabbing my phone from where it fell on my chest. The notification shows motion detected in the upstairs hallway, but when I press on it, it only shows me the stillness of an empty place, like a photograph, were it not for the video noise. With a press, I switch to the other camera downstairs. Lawrence is on the couch, slightly shifted from the last time I saw him, but otherwise asleep. There's a bit of pixel shifting on his face, so I zoom in to get a look at it, quickly realizing that is because his expression is changing rapidly, as if in pain and his lips are moving. It takes a moment to realize he's talking in his sleep. I press the speaker icon that lets me hear what's going on. No, please. No, you can't. Even if it's just in his sleep, this is the first time I've ever heard Lawrence's voice like this. Scared. He almost sounds like a completely different person. Certainly not anyone the 10-year-old me would have recognized. No! Lawrence shouts in his sleep. Leave him alone! A shape to the right of my bed catches me off guard. A dark mass in my peripheral vision. I glance up to see it, and a small gasp escapes me. It's Lawrence, but not Lawrence. He's standing on two legs, for one, but also his face different, distorted. The word that comes to mind is polluted, just before he falls on me, wrapping his cold hands around my throat and begins to choke me. Even as my hands claw helplessly at his, legs kicking, I look up at him in a distant sense of horror. This impossible man, this not Lawrence, trying to understand. His twisted face smiles down at me, not just a smile, an angry grin, as if he loathes me, but at the same time enjoys squeezing the life from me. Meanwhile, the dark room around us, my childhood bedroom, the place where I used to hide from the world, but perhaps this man the most, grows darker, dimmer, less colorful, and my legs kick softer, my hands relaxing. Just before the lights go out, some voice at the back of my head tells me that I'm dying, and that this is the end of my story if I don't do something right now. And I can swear it's not my own voice, but a woman's voice, a familiar one. Either way, the voice is right, and the thought of dying at this man's hands is enough to anger me into action. With the little strength I have left in my body, I concentrate on moving my right arm up and out to look for something I can use. My hand knocks over empty beer cans on the nightstand, sending them clanging and crashing to the floor, the sound of it sounding miles away. Then my hand hits something harder, something cold and solid. I whirl my fingers to close around it before I even know what it is, and I still don't know as I push everything I have into my arm and swing it up at not Lawrence to smash it over his head. What happens instead is that it passes right through him like a fireplace poker through a burnt-out log. And he turns to screaming hot ash over me, disappearing into the air. The grip around my throat disappears with him, and all that's left is me in bed gripping my old baseball trophy. I sit up, grasping and coughing and swallowing down great gulps of sweet air until my vision is steady, and I'm able to get to my feet. A moment later, I'm stumbling down the stairs and running to the living room to shout at Lawrence, who himself is already sitting up like he's waiting for me. "What the hell's going on?" I yell. "Who was that?" "I told you not to come here," he replies softly and quietly, frowning up at me as if to leave it at that. "It's not an answer, Lawrence. Something just tried to kill me up there, and it looked just like you." Thinking about its twisted grin, the way it felt so familiar, like a long look at something I'd only glanced at my whole life, I add, "How long has it been here?" And Lawrence, he doesn't so much answer me as he closes his eyes, squeezes his face up tight and lets out a pained scream that's so loud I cover my ears. When I uncover him, I hear an awful sound like wet branches breaking under feet. Still screaming but muffled and choked by pain, Lawrence grips the couch cushions as his legs twist and rearrange. manipulated into a new shape by unseen hands. Then he stands up, a broken puppet on mutilated legs, and his face is no longer his. An angry smile back from the ash. Maybe if I had the vantage point of the camera on the shelf, I could have seen it coming, but since I don't, I caught unaware as he reached back to the couch, pulls a half-empty bottle from beneath the cushions, and cracks me upside the head with it. Jagged glass and warm beer explode my senses, and then I'm tumbling through the air, not knowing which way is up, eyes rolling into the back of my head. By the time I regain some sense of myself, I feel carpet rubbing against my back, followed by the thump, 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 thump of stairs bouncing against my head. I reach out for passing guardrails to stop myself, but my hand passes right through where two of them are missing, and then a moment later they're all gone, and so are the stairs. When I realize which room I'm being dragged into, I find enough fight in myself to claw at the doorframe and kick against Lawrence's powerful grip. It's like I'm a kid again, and he's so much bigger and stronger than me. A towering presence I couldn't stand up to even if I dared. My fingers pulled free from the doorframe. He lifts me up to look me in the face, his grin like hot dumpster stench, and says, "This is where you belong." In a voice that belongs to Lawrence and not Lawrence all at once. Two voices sliced into strips and laid side by side, and then hurls me into the bathtub. I crumple inside the tub, a ragdoll of bruises. My eyes sting from wetness, and only now do I realize my head's bleeding, the blood seeping into the corner of my eyes. And I try to wipe it away, thinking of Mom, thinking of the bathtub, thinking of the stain that just wouldn't come out no matter how much I scrubbed. No matter how much Lawrence yelled at me to try harder, to do something right. The squeak of a faucet becomes the gurgle of water flowing, and then it's not just my head and my eyes that are wet, as the bathtub fills, and not Lawrence, holds me down like it's nothing to him at all. It makes me so angry, that face. I don't know why I've ever expected anything from this man with a face like that. I don't know how I expected to ever make him proud or at least leave me alone. A face like that, a smile like that, is capable of only total destruction of everyone around it. And it takes a day like today to figure that out. With my back underwater, I drop my leg, pull my foot back as far as it goes, and kick not Lawrence and that face as hard as I can. Even as it connects, knocking that smile right off his face, I feel the urge to do it again. A feeling like this can become an addiction. But I know better than to let the surprise go to waste, seeing as it might be my only chance to get out of this tub alive. So instead, I shoot up out of the water, grab him by his bony shoulders, and pull him in with me. Wrestling myself on top of him, I hold him face down in the rising water and put all my weight on his back. The tub's too small for him to maneuver his arms or find any perches, and though he bucks and thrashes like a feral animal, I manage to stay on top, wrapping my hands around his neck for good measure, squeezing it tight, and I think, "Is this how you would do it?" And I shout, "Are you proud of me now?" Right then, just as a big bubble escapes his mouth, and his splashing and thrashing begin to calm, I glance over at the sink across the bathroom. Above it is Lawrence's smile looking back at me, so angry and yet so alive, that monstrous grin that terrifies me. And it takes a moment, I mean a good second or two, to realize who I'm looking at. When I do, I let go. I can't get out of the bathtub quick enough, nearly slipping and breaking my neck, stepping backward onto the tile, the wet tile. As I do, Lawrence pushes himself out of the half-filled water and turns over messily, his legs no longer the puppet things they just were, but broken, useless things. He stares at me and me at him, both of us gasping at air that burns our throats and lungs. Eventually, finally, he's the first to speak. This'll be yours soon enough, you know, he says. And it's the most honest thing I've ever heard him say. So much so that I barely recognize him, this man, who didn't so much raise me as he did make everything else seem easy to deal with in comparison. In return, I offer my hand and say, you keep it, Dad. I think it suits you better. When I leave on Monday, I leave with no bags at all. I hope you enjoyed This Will Be Yours by Brian Martinez, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Brian-Martinez. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Brian-Martinez. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Me, personally, I wouldn't mind being bequeathed a demonic force, as long as I could use it to smite my enemies. But maybe that's something I should keep to myself and not share with a wide audience of listeners. Though be assured, none of you are on my list. Only if you stop listening do we have an issue. In our second story from Dominic Eagle, we have the strange story of the Thorns, a family that seems to have a real issue with the town their home overlooks. But surely they aren't as bad as they sound. Maybe they're even worse. Without further ado, I present to you The Possession of the Thorns. It would be an understatement to say that nobody in town cared for the Thorne family. They were vile, self-centered monsters, that cliched breed of insufferable people born into wealth. Franklin Thorne never worked a day in his life, and Mary Thorne, upon marrying the horrid man, forgot her impoverished parents at the drop of a hat. Things worsened when they had children. Lillian Thorne and James Thorne were just as wretched, insidious creatures born with silver spoons in their mouths, and they still wailed for golden ones. Their parents obliged, of course. Mr. Thorne would never have to lift a finger in his life, and he certainly wasn't going to demand any other life for his children. He wouldn't do anything. Lillian and James wouldn't ever do anything, and neither would their children. And when they did venture into the realm of peasants, the town, the Thorns took great pleasure in making the lives of their neighbors a misery. Mrs. Thorne put an end to a bakery that got her order wrong. She buried that business. Mr. Thorne bought a block of apartments just to evict every last tenant, folk he deemed unfit for town. Lillian and James collaborated to vandalize the town school with the words, "Education for Neanderthals." Yeah, it's safe to say that the town folk were perfectly happy for the Thorns to stay in their castle atop the hill. And Mrs. Thorne's parents, the Harrisons, felt great shame when it came to talk of her daughter. How could she marry such a brute? What happened to that little girl we loved? Her children are monsters. I always pitied Mr. and Mrs. Thorne, Mary's parents. They were a lovely elderly couple who deeply loved their daughter. They even loved their cruel grandchildren, though they scarcely had the opportunity to see them. Mary would allow her parents to visit the manor atop the hill on the condition that they bow to every whim of Lillian and James. And the Harrisons would do just that because they were good people. Such good people that even when a thing of unimaginable horror happened to the monsters of the manor, the grandparents did everything in their power to save their family. "Brian," Mrs. Harrison said, "do they still work with the vicar?" I was in the midst of refilling her tea pitcher, and the question caught me off guard. The shop keeps me pretty busy these days, I said, nodding at the kitchen behind me. But Elise left, the new vicar by the name of John, runs things at the church now. You and Thomas haven't been in there in years. Why don't you ever stop by? It was a stupid question, and I already knew the answer. I wish I hadn't asked. I desperately desired to retract the question, but it was too late. Mrs. Harrison's dejected expression said it all. Oh, I don't know, Brian. You know what people are like, Mrs. Harrison whispered, hanging her head. I nodded. Yes, I do. I'm sorry, Barbara. She shook her head. Quite all right, Brian. Quite all right. Anyway, I was asking about the vicar, John, is it? Well, I was asking about him because I... Oh, it's silly, really. Go on, I said, sitting down and opting to take my lunch break with the lonely woman. She sighed. Do you believe in God, Brian? Of course, I said. I may not help at the church as often, but I still go every couple of weeks or so. Barbara nodded, gulping. And what about, you know? The woman trailed off, and I sat patiently, waiting for her to continue. Some part of me knew what she was going to ask next, but I waited. I contemplated my answer. Did I believe in that? What about the devil? The old woman whispered. I paused, eyeing the empty cup before Barbara. I started to pour fresh tea from the pitcher, concealing my frowning expression behind the rising plume of steam. I still didn't have an answer for her. Not a convincing one, at least. I don't know, I answered, feeling disappointed in my non-committal response. Barbara twitched uncomfortably. Well, I... Thank you for the tea, dear. Well, I just wanted to talk to you about it because we're close. Is everything all right, Barbara? I asked. She shook her head. No, Brian. Everything is far from all right. I've not seen Thomas this week. Is he okay? I asked, nervously eyeing the silent woman. Is there something you need to tell me, Barbara? It's not like you talk about anything heavy, certainly not anything theological. The woman sniffled, and I could see that she was stifling tears. She bit the bottom of her lip, steadying it before it would reveal her sorrow. But it was a fruitless endeavor. I'd already produced a fresh tissue for her, and the very sight of that seemed to open the floodgates. The woman started sobbing silently. Please, Barbara, I begged, tell me, what's happening? The grandmother blubbered. It's not... I don't know what to believe anymore, Brian. And Thomas won't leave his room. Not after what he saw. What did you see? I asked. She sniffled. We were celebrating Christmas with Franklin, Mary, and the children. At first, it was a lovely affair, peaceful, cozy. It was such a mild winter last year, wasn't it? I nodded, brow furrowing, as I prepared for yet another tale of horror about the thorns. I was surprised to hear it from the mouth of Mary's own mother, however. She spent her whole life defending her children and grandchildren. What horrifying story is there about to leave her lips, I wondered. I can't have imagined the answer in a lifetime. Thomas and I were pleasantly surprised by the well-behaved nature of the children. Often we leave the manor feeling exhausted. They play all sorts of games. One time during hide-and-seek, they left me in a locked wardrobe for 2 hours before Mary found me. But there were no antics this Christmas. There was barely any conversation, Barbara said. Thomas and I merely counted our blessings and vowed to enjoy the quiet, however brief it may have been. But we... Well, it all... Oh. Barbara burst into a flood of tears, and I desperately attempted to console her. It's okay, Barbara, I said, reaching across the table and stroking her arm. Just take your time. I only want to help. Do you, Brian? Will you? Even after I've told you what happened at dinner? The old woman whispered. My chest tightened. What happened to dinner, Barbara? Mary's mother took several labored breaths, lifting the tea to her lips. With trembling hands, some of the shaking drink spilled over the rim of the cup. Barbara didn't seem to notice it coating her fingers, but I was sure it must have been scalding hot. So I reached across the table to wipe a few drips of piping hot liquid from her skin. "You'll burn," Barbara coldly whispered. "I beg your pardon?" I gasped, gripped by horror. "That's... no, not you, dear. That's what Mary said to me." Barbara shivered. "It's horrible," I said. "No, it wasn't her," the woman explained tearfully. She eyed me with an awful, darkening glint in her eyes, like her very soul was departing her body before us. They blackened until the whites of her eyes vanished, and when Thomas told her off for being rude, she said, "You'll burn too, old man." And it was... I don't understand, Brian. Her voice bellowed in an impossible volume. It filled the room and shook the furniture. Frames fell from the walls. I stroked the woman's arm again. "It's okay, Barbara. It's over now." She shook her head. It wasn't just her, Brian. There was something wrong with all four of them. Franklin, James, Lily, and all turned their heads to face Thomas and me. They were smiling, silently smiling, as if the four of them were privy to some ghastly secret. "It sounds absolutely dreadful. Is Thomas okay?" I asked. "Do you want me to pay a visit and talk to him? It isn't good for him to stay cooped up." Barbara sighed. "You don't believe me, do you?" "I do, Barbara." "What makes you say that?" I gasped. "No, I just mean that you think what everybody else thinks," the woman replied. "You think the Thorns are dreadful people. Yet, while they do dreadful things, this was not that. I told you that this wasn't like other Christmases. They were different, Brian. That voice and the blackness that filled Mary's eyes, it wasn't natural. How do you explain that in an earthly way?" Thomas saw the same thing. I paused, sighing. "There are a million different explanations, Barbara." "I wanted to speak to the vicar, Brian," Barbara said, "but I don't have the energy to deal with the nosy townsfolk. Would you ask him to meet me?" I tried to reason with her. "Barbara, the devil isn't... please," she begged. I held my tongue and nodded my head firmly. "Okay, Barbara, I'll ask him." To my surprise, John was ecstatic about the prospect of helping the Harrisons. I'd frequently viewed him as a calm and collected vicar, the sort of man who was religious in a casual, laid-back fashion. I'd expected him to secretly reveal a belief only in God, not the devil, but the man became possessed by a form of righteousness, as if the Holy Spirit filled his very soul. "And they've not been to church in years?" John asked me as we stood outside the door to the Harrisons' household. "They stopped going shortly after Lillian and James vandalized the local school," I said. "The Thorns don't come to town often. The townsfolk use Mary's parents as a punching bag for their frustrations." The door suddenly opened, and we were surprised to find Thomas in the doorway. He wore a gaunt face and sulking lips. "Thomas!" I practically shouted. "Are you well?" The man shrugged. "As well as possible in times like these, Brian. And you must be John, the new vicar." John smiled, shaking Thomas's hands. "Well, I've been here for 3 years, actually. May we come inside, Thomas?" The man nodded, ushering us into the living room. He and Barbara sat on the sofa opposite ours. "Thank you for coming, John. And you didn't have to join, Brian," Barbara smiled. "I do appreciate it, of course, but you shouldn't feel obligated. I'm sorry for snapping at you the other day." I shook my head. "You didn't snap, Barbara. And I want to be here. I want to put all of this right." "When did Mary Franklin?" John suddenly asked. Thomas's eyes widened. "Well, till 2007, I believe, 17 years ago. Lillian's 12 and James is 11. 17 years, John repeated, seemingly fascinated. That's a long time to spend isolated at the top of the hill. And the family members rarely come to town?
Barbara sighed. When they do, it usually ends in tears for somebody.
Evil lurks in cold, lonely places, John thoughtfully said. It preys on the isolated, the strong and the weak, the kind and the cruel. Barbara sobbed, and Thomas wrapped his arm around her. My wife and I have struggled for years, long before this, but trust me, Vicar, this wasn't our daughter in there. There's nothing human left in that house. John nodded. Brian and I will pay them a visit. My eyes bulged. Pardon?
John rose to his feet, slipping his arms into the sleeves of his coat.
Well, I shouldn't go alone, should I? We're dealing with something hostile, something beyond mortal comprehension.
But we don't know that.
I trailed off, not wanting to offend the Harrisons. What if, instead of hostile demons, we only find a hostile family?
John passed my coat as I begrudgingly rose to my feet.
Well, whatever the situation, the word of the Lord will save their souls.
Thank you, Brian, Barbara whispered, watching as we strolled out of the living room. Bless your soul.
It's all going to be okay, Barbara, I replied. Though I knew whatever we were to find in that house, it would be nothing good. We drove in silence for several minutes, but the vicar finally spoke his mind.
I'm a little disappointed, Brian, John said. What happened to that young, bubbly man who used to talk so excitedly about God?
God, John. God, not the devil, I sighed.
You can't have one side of the coin without the other. It's an impossibility, John replied.
I don't believe that, I said.
So you believe in heaven, but not hell? You cherry-pick the parts of Christianity that you like? The vicar asked, raising an eyebrow.
I don't know what I believe, John. I replied, there's an almighty creator, I believe that.
Why must there also be an evil counterpart?
You can bury your head, but you can't escape the darkness, John whispered. Heaven, hell, or the shadowy voice in the middle. It exists, whether you like it or not. If we run from evil, it pursues. If we push it back, we fill that shadowy crevice with light instead.
But evil never truly goes away, does it?
We're doomed to fight an everlasting battle against horrors, I asked. Earth already sounds like hell.
It may well be, Brian, John nodded. It may well be.
After following a winding road up the hillside, we finally arrived at the gates to the Thorn Manor, a house I'd only ever seen as a pinprick in the distance. I'd never been so foolish as to leave the safety of town and venture into the lion's den. But John and I jumped out of the car and walked over to the intimidating iron entryway. We heaved a gate each, squeaking the rusty barriers inwards, and 50 feet before us, the Thorn Manor loomed, an impressive abode buried beneath dense layers of vines. It looked intentionally rustic, a glamorous modern mansion, not a forgotten relic. Looking through the darkened, secretive window panes, however, I reminded myself that the house within was most certainly haunted, whether by monsters or men. John took powerful strides toward the front door, and I could scarcely keep up with the deceptively fast man.
Wait!
I huffed as the vicar strolled across the porch. He rapped his knuckles on the door 3 times.
It's fine, Brian, he said. I am a man of God, and anything unholy in here should fear me.
Before I could respond, a latch slid behind the door. The friction of wooden against wood, but it was followed by silence. A long minute of silence.
Hello? Mr. Thorne? Mrs. Thorne?
John eventually called.
No answer.
We should go, I whispered. The vicar shook his head and he called again. I'm going to open the door now.
No, I cried.
But the holy man had already pressed his hand against the smooth oak, and he pushed forcefully.
John was not a man of tact. He was a man of action. And it would nearly be the death of me. "Mr. and Mrs. Thorne," John yelled into the expansive entryway. I followed, admiring the grandeur of the abode, the eerily quiet, abandoned abode. The only sound of life was a shadow that flickered for the briefest moment on a wall at the top of the steps, a large staircase that led into a darkened world. "Are you up there?" the vicar asked, walking toward the stairs. "John, let's proceed with caution," I warned, following him. "Time does not favor the cautious, Brian," John explained, supporting himself on the banister. "Come on, let's put an end to this." When we reached the top of the stairs, I flicked a light switch. No response. Not willing to walk through a black abyss, I removed my phone from my pocket and lit the way with the torch. I screamed. Standing in the middle of the corridor, back turned to us, was Mary Thorne. But her head was twisted 180 degrees. She directly eyed us with black pupils and a toothy grin. "I would ask God what he thinks of you, John, but he's dead," the woman giggled in a voice that rippled through the very foundations of the house. There was no denying it, not anymore. The inexplicable contortion of her neck, the black eyes, the bellow that had the power to sway a building. John was right. "The devil is real," the vicar whispered, as if only truly believing it at that moment. As the man fumbled for his Bible and cross, Mary giggled and began slowly walking toward us. The doors of the hallway slowly opened, and her family members joined her. Franklin, Lillian, and James, all four Thorns, walked backwards with heads inexplicably turned 180 degrees, four crusty smiles on inhuman faces. John cleared his throat. "I say this to you. Peter tells us to be alert and of sober mind." The family did not stop smiling. They continued strolling quietly toward us, grinning faces not wavering for a second. John continued undeterred. "Your enemy, the devil, prowls round like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour." The walls of the house began to groan, and the joints of the family members began to crack, as if they were struggling to walk as humans should. But their grins persisted. "Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing the same sufferings." John paused, quivering at the four family members mere feet away from us. "The same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world." Suddenly, a wisp of wind swept the hallway, a gnawing gust that swept the vicar and me to the ground. I grunted in pain, massaging the back of my head, and I looked up to face a truly terrifying sight. The Thorns were disintegrating. "No," John gasped, stumbling to his feet. "No, wait." "Don't worry, little holy man," Mary giggled, body crumbling into a pile of ash. "You'll see the Thorns again, in hell." The vicar and I screamed as the four family members rotted before our very eyes, becoming skeletal forms and then ash. Four mounds of ash that were swept away by a breeze from an unknown source. All windows in the house were closed. We never spoke to anyone of what we saw, not even Barbara and Thomas. John, with his head lowered in guilt, quietly revealed that he had failed. He cast the evil from the house, but at the cost of their souls. "They're already dead, John," I finally said. The man lifted his head in surprise. "What?" "Whatever possessed him, it killed them long before we arrived," I whispered. "I could feel it." I hope you enjoyed The Possession of the Thorns by Dominic Eagle, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, well, you can support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dominic-Eagle. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/DOMINIC-EAGLE. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I'd like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring Twice the Terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs. Or become a patron for as little as $5 a month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012. All of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, or X, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Story Time, dating back 10 years to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, or X, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep. If you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.